Okay, we're beginning chapter 8. Chapter 8 is idolatry that plunges a soul into turmoil. Idolatry plunges the soul into turmoil. We were created to worship only the true God, and worshiping an idol, whatever kind of idol it might be, plunges our soul into turmoil. And if we remember from the beginning chapters what our soul is meant to be like, we could see why worshiping some idol that by its very nature programs our way of thinking and our thoughts and our desires will just really turn us upside down and inside out. And the first thing, you know, before we even go to the questions, the first thing that D. Pennock says on page 136, the beginning of the chapter, is the greatest mental turmoil from idols probably comes from idolatry that goes back to childhood, to a parent who wanted to possess and to be God to the child. The greatest mental turmoil. That doesn't mean that all of us are in this kind of situation, but she's saying that this is the greatest kind of mental turmoil from idols. We're talking about parental possessiveness. And those of us who are parents, this is a tough thing to sort out. And of course, the thing is that all of us who have been parents, and also those of us who have never been parents, we all had parents. So this kind of influence from our parents is what this chapter is not completely about, because about two-thirds of the way through, D. Pennock mentions that even those who don't have this kind of a source for problems that come from idols, the points that she makes, drawing upon the spiritual healing teachings of the fathers and the mothers of the church, these points that she's making, picking this particular example, all of that advice applies to all of us who suffer from idolatry. And, well, if we are not fixed on God as we ought to be, and that includes pretty much everyone, then idols are going to be involved. So all of the advice that has to do with idolatry and fighting free of idolatry that she gives us in this chapter, it applies to all of us. But this is the particular example of a source of idolatry that she's going to talk about here. And she gives the example of Eve and her possessiveness about the first son, first mother, first son. It's got to be significant. And who is that first son?
Cain.
And she makes the point that Eve has a sense of ownership of him as her son. And this is not hard for us to understand, I think, you know, for any of us probably. They always used to talk about Jewish mothers, you know. But Jewish mothers, Italian mothers, Pennsylvania Dutch mothers, you know, I think the idea here is that mothers are tempted by this sense that they have given birth to this child. It is their child. I mean, it is their child. They've given birth to the child. It's flesh of their flesh in a way that's different from, you know, Adam, when Eve is made, he says, at last, this is flesh of my flesh, bone of my bone. This is definitely 100% the case when a woman gives birth to a child. And here is the idea that this is my child, even before it is God's child. It is my child. So, the questions. Describe Eve's parental possessiveness. And she asks us to compare it with Egypt's effort to hold Israel in bondage and not let Israel go to serve God. Can anyone, first of all, describe Eve's parental possessiveness? I guess I've already kind of cut into that a little bit.
Well, she says, I have acquired a man with God.
Right. I have acquired a man with God. And the parallel between that possessive sense of having, almost, where's Adam in this? I mean, you know, forget Adam. I mean, a woman can give birth and the man could be on the other side of the planet or gone. So there's this possessiveness that cuts out even the father. It isn't our child here. And this is Eve we're talking about. I have acquired a man with God. How can we compare that with Egypt's effort to hold Israel in bondage? In the middle of 136, it says, like Egypt, Eve is trying to hold a child of God in bondage. Israel is God's. He is the one who gives life. When we as Orthodox, when we talk about birth, we talk about how a woman who gives birth has become close to God. It affirms at least part of what Eve is saying. That is the importance of the father. Of course, it's child. No child is just a mother and no father. Jesus Christ has a human mother, but his father is his father from eternity. I mean, he is the image of his father. So when we try to hold on to our children as our children, it's easy for us to forget that our children belong to God. We're all kind of in the situation that that Joseph was in a sense. We are taking care of these children that belong to God. They don't belong to us. If we try to, on the basis of a worldly wisdom, protect them and shield them from the things that we fear and give them the things that we can give them, of necessity, we're going to be bringing them up in our own image, not in the image and likeness of God, who intends to be our Father. And His Son comes into the world in order to make us able to say, along with Jesus Christ, our Father. That's how it's meant to be. We are meant to be children of God. And our children are, as they get older, and I look, even mean our childbearing years, they're short. When you're young, you think, oh, I want to have a child. It's a lifetime commitment. Well, you will always be that child's father or that child's mother. But they're not going to be around for the rest of your life in the way that they were when you were fathering them or mothering them. We had 5 kids, and even all put together, that's only a portion of our life. If we hang around a little longer, I mean, it will be a short portion of our lives. Even with 5 kids, we had our first 2 girls, and they started to grow up all too quickly, and we became Orthodox and quick had some more kids because we weren't finished being parents. We wanted more children. I don't know if I would feel that way now if I could go back in time. I had that discussion with Sharon just the other day. If we could go back now, I mean, you know, would we, and we knew everything about our adult children and what our relationship was going to be like after they were grown. I mean, what do you think? So, well, you know, Sharon, I said, oh, you would. Oh, I don't know, you know. Of course, you'd have to go back to the beginning and have your understanding and maybe bad perspective, you know, from now on, you know, and sour grapes and all that intact back to that point. Things don't work like that. Maybe it's the best that they don't. Because anyway, well, one good thing, I know this, raising children matures you. At least I think it should. It's supposed to. If you never have children, there are ways, there are things about life and yourself that you never learn. And so that is not a spiritual benefit that you have in mind when you first have children. You are very, very possessive of those children, I think. All of us are. There's always a struggle. I mean, we want our children to be able to be free and independent and be able to survive well and make their way in the world. But then, of course, we have only our own experience and our own convictions about what is good and appropriate and positive, and we have convictions about what isn't and all of that, and we have our own idols, and it's a complicated sort of business. But when it comes to admitting that our children do not belong to us, that they are in no way our children as possessions, making a human being, having the powerful experience of possessing a human being. I mean, Pharaoh possessed thousands and thousands of human beings. Their lives were dependent on him, dependent on his authority, dependent on his power, dependent on his organization of the Egyptian state. It was a very highly developed state. Whenever people didn't have food, they went down to Egypt because Egypt is where they had the granaries in the Nile. It was a rich place. And Pharaoh was the patriarchal father of all of that. And these Israelites were part of his possessions. He pretends at one point that he's going to let them go, but then he goes after them. And why does he go after them? He pursues them. He tries to bring them back. And Deepenik is, I think, implying, as here at the bottom, talking at the same time about how we have this possessive tendency where our children are concerned, and at the same time talking about Pharaoh and Eve, three things at once. This Eve pattern, a pattern of a woman with this possessiveness, a desire to be God to someone. And we are to our children. I mean, the voice of the parent as a child, you know, it's close to an experience of absolute power, the God of the household. So a mother in the Eve pattern, or a parent in the Eve pattern, aims to possess the child's affection, to possess the, what do we desire our children's affection? Good grief. That is absolutely true. It's one of the things that you miss. I mean, I often talk about that, not even realizing how I'm exposing myself when I do it, I guess, how much I miss having little girls. I loved being the father of little girls. The purity of affection that little children give you, and there's something special about the relationship between a father and his daughters, and there's something special about the relationship between a mother and her sons. Not that you don't love your sons, you do, but it's a whole different experience. And so, you know, I can understand what's being said here, that Eve's desire is to possess the child's affection. It's one of the top experiences in life, to be loved by a child, and to envy and cut off any relationship it might have with others, that the child might have with others, that could rival that attachment. It's very difficult giving your daughters away to be married. Every society has ritual connected with it, and part of it, a large part of it, I think, is to make it easier for the parents to give up their children to someone else who is going to take your place in that child's affection. It's going to be different. I'll always love you. You'll always be my daddy. Yes, yes, I'm hearing that. Even while I don't believe it for a minute, I mean, I wasn't born yesterday. I got married. Where do you think you came from? I understand the truth of what's going on. You are giving this child away to another life, to another person. They come back the week after they're married, it will never be the same as it was. You hold on to that. I think it's difficult. That's difficult to understand what's being talked about here. What parental actions can keep a child irresponsible and childish and somewhat dependent upon a parent?
You tie them up in a room. That would do it.
Yeah. It would, if you could live with that. I mean, you know, there are ways of accomplishing that without rope. Yeah.
Well, on page 138, he talks about trying to inculcate the child with a conviction that they have core judgment, and you know.
I mean, not that that's true, right?
Yeah. Well, needing them to keep coming back to you, though.
Which is the last thing you would really want, and what, you know, we say that, but then on the other hand, what parent doesn't enjoy it when their children come to them? And you know, one of the last things you say as they leave the house is, I hope you know you can always come to me. After reading this chapter, I'm not even sure we should say that. I mean, I guess it depends on how things have been for the previous 20-odd years. But yeah, I relate to what you're saying. And we can tie our kids up emotionally, psychologically, in a way that keeps them irresponsible and childish. Well,
137, it says, has a possessive parent invariably puts a child down, makes it feel inadequate, often without a conscious intention to do so. And even with such intermittent flattery as to give the child frequent sensations of superiority.
Yeah, this has gotten to be an epidemic, I think, in our country. Each generation, as we grow up, we come in for our grief and expression of the irritation of society at our generation. Mine had it. You know, the current generation of young people just coming out of high school and college, what I often hear said about them is that they have an absolute conviction that they are special and they deserve X, a whole bunch of things, and not necessarily with effort expended, but that they ought to have certain things. Because why? Because, well, they've been flattered, you know, by the educational system and by their parents, and just kind of flattered. On what basis? We do that. We do that with our children. We want them to have a high opinion, a good opinion of themselves. Those two comments, I would say, that Theodora points to, they're actually the last two of five, I think, in that paragraph. The first one, make themselves seem indispensable. You need me. You don't realize it, but I've protected you for so long. And then, of course, the memory of a child, it goes back into this dim past. Their parents have always been there. They know that they were once very small. I mean, how did they get to grow up? They had food, they had clothing, they had shelter. They weren't able to provide it. And all this protection from bad things. And what parent can resist and there's a reality involved there. I mean, human beings take longer to mature than just about anything else that God has created. And so parents are indispensable. What's that?
Sometimes we never do.
Never do what?
Mature.
Yeah, well, that's true. You know, and well, it goes for us as parents too. But, that's what you're saying, right? That's true. I mean, we have children before we're grown up. Our daughters, Elizabeth and Kathy, they figured this out somewhere along the line. And reflecting, and I guess watching us raise the boys as well, some years later, during their high school years, they realized that when they were very small, their parents were not yet mature, which they weren't in a position to figure out when they were very small. But somewhere along teenage, that was one of the things that they figured out. I mean, some of the things that you guys did, you know, good grief. You were kids yourselves. Well, we were. We got married when we were 17. Of course, we were still children raising children. No, but yet we make ourselves seem indispensable to the child's welfare and survival. Second, we can make a child feel that it can't manage for long without the parent. Now, when they're very small, that's true. Children need nurturing. But the nurturing is to bring them to the point that they don't need us. That's what we're supposed to do. So this is a move in the opposite direction. Spiritually, it is missing the mark when it comes to parenthood. Every one of these examples. Making the child feel that it can't manage for long without the parent. No longer true beyond a certain point, even during the maturing process of a young person. Third, to keep the child feeling incompetent and dependent upon a parent for life. And the two things that Theodora, you know, mentioned, putting children down, making them feel inadequate, often without realizing it, wanting to protect them. These bad things are going to happen to you. And then the flattery. I mean, it's confusing. So these are certainly all things that parents can do to keep a child irresponsible and childish and somewhat dependent on a parent. I don't want to just talk about myself, but you reflect on your own childhood and the manner in which you left the home.
To me, there's a difficulty here, and it seems to me that she's talking about we should be looking at this as children, not as parents. It's hard for me because all of us are both that are parents. I'm just trying to decide whether it's even worth going down the pathway based on where she's trying to go here.
What do you mean?
Well, what I want to say is striking the right balance of being able to provide the ability to say, you know, I'm here, but not set up a situation that where it's a need, you know, where I can, for instance, I mean, I have one right here, mm-hmm. that it could be said that what we're doing was setting her up in a business and that we could be trying to set up a situation like that. I hope that's not what's going on. But you know, it could be the appropriateness of, okay, Johnny is about to marry her next May. Now it's time. How do you do this without creating that situation?
Well, it's too late now.
It's too late.
It's happened already.
Yeah. Cutting you off, Becca, that's it.
Don't you think? I mean, you know, as far as
really
preventing the situation, you know, it's, you know, about how the children grow up, you know.
Yeah.
The after effect is what, you know, once your kids leave the house, then you sit back and wait to figure out how badly you did. You know, as based on, not depending on what they do immediately, you know, because, you know, I mean, you know, you throw somebody who can't swim into the ocean, say, well, you know, here it is, you know, you want the real world, splash, you know, and it may be a while. They may flounder around and do, you know, just end up in all kinds of horrible situations, you know, just like, you know, many of us did. But what happens in the long run? That's when it tests out. I mean, and you know, can they, you know, my old standby, you know, that the first major step toward maturity comes when you forgive your parents for having raised you. I mean, I think that's absolutely, you know, the case. You know that, but that's not so easy, and it depends. If you've had one of the kind of parents that Deepanek is describing, that may take some doing. That may take. There are different kinds of parental abuse. In other words, if we are not living the lives spiritually that we ought to live, there are going to be consequences, you know, for our children. They will end up having to deal with some of the things that we have not yet dealt with. Just like we're dealing with things that our parents hadn't dealt with. I mean, how else could it be? Now, if our parents really did love us, and we really do love our children in spite of our background and imperfections and how many times we miss the mark, if we really do love them and we love God, you know, and we really don't want to be God for them, you know, and we really love them, then a lot of kids will see through all of the superficial stuff, and they know whether their parents love them or not. They grow to understand their parents' shortcomings, sometimes maybe better than their parents do, you know, because they love their parents too. And you have insight into your parents, you know, sometimes, you know. So it's complicated, you know, in a good kind of way, because you're dealing with human beings, you know, people who have spiritual capacities, people who, the more they mature, the more insight they have, the more self-knowledge they hopefully have, the more insight into their parents' lives they have, to the extent that their parents don't hide from them. Some parents don't let their children know anything about them. I mean, they end up being a cipher, you know, to their children. My parents' generation was more like that than we are now. I mean, we're all over everybody telling them our life story and our trials and travails and all. It's gotten to be the thing that everybody does, you know. I mean, you share. I mean, whether people want to be shared with or not, I don't know. It started coming in the 70s, and it's just, you know, we just inundate one another with, you know, intimate details, you know, about practically everything. I mean, my parents didn't do that, you know. Grandparents didn't. People didn't do that in those days, but we do it now. So they're going to figure us out, hopefully, during the process of their coming to grips with reality, you know.
Especially down south, everyone down here just go to the grocery store and hear people's life stories.
There are no secrets.
No. Grocery line, you better hope it's not more than 5 minutes long, because I've heard it.
Yeah, yeah. And New York people just abuse each other. You know, they just, you know, they're mean to each other in the checkout line. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there are cultural differences, that's for sure. Question number 3, when a child is conditioned to believe it has bad judgment, how can this affect its decisions in life? There's that point somewhere, I don't know, middle teenage years, where I think as parents we have a temptation to emphasize to our children, you know, and at least 2 out of the 3, and probably all 3 boys, one of the messages that I left them with, or at least tried to, I'm sure they ignored it, you know, which is probably the best thing, was that you have everything you need now except experience. Which is true, but did I really need that? I mean, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's because you're fearful. What is going to happen to this kid? How are they going to get from this protective environment out into the world, get themselves right side up, learn how to swim, and move in some positive direction such that bad things are not going to happen to them? And so you're worried, you're afraid, and you say things like that. So probably I had an influence on my you know, especially the boys, you know, convince them that they had bad judgment. Or maybe there's rebellion to just go out, I'm going to just go be, do whatever I want. I don't care if it's good judgment or bad judgment. And twice now, in my own family and in another family, I've heard words that were very similar from parents quoting their boys just about to go out into the world. I am going to learn by hard knocks. Don't tell me anything, you know. And this is a personality thing. I mean, everybody, you know, some kids don't do it that way. But some of us, boys in particular, you know, I mean, let me go out there and take the bad, the worst it's got. You know, so there is that. So you're not conditioned. That person does not believe that. They don't care whether they have bad judgment or not. It's a matter of freedom. Let me out of here. Let me hit the line, you know. Yeah, but bad judgment, I mean, you know, if you're fearful and concerned, I can think of certain of my children who maybe have felt that way. What role did I play in that? I don't know. Kids are easier to deal with when they're young. I mean, she says some things in here later that really are terrible to hear. That if you have been controlling, they may go out and look for a similar sort of situation. It's the kind of thing you fear. Being a parent is not a lot of fun in a lot of ways. You end up learning things about yourself you would rather not have found out. And well, she's not giving us any comfort here. Okay, condition to have bad judgment. Page 138, I have a note to look there. A child dominated by an Eve parent. And an Eve parent is a parent who wants to be God to their child. So it's not just women. There's a particular reason she picks on Eve here, but I think it would take time if we went into that. But a child dominated by an Eve parent, a parent who wants to be God to their child, and is in a state of beguilement, as she says Eve is, a child dominated by such a parent becomes mentally crippled, inculcated with a conviction that it has poor judgment, so that it will always need a parent to correct it or rescue it. Such a child can labor a long time trying to become independent. I don't know. Boys and girls are different. People are different. But we're talking about someone who has had this particular mental turmoil from idolatry of their parent. And you don't necessarily realize that that is your relationship to your parent either. I know when my father died, you know, Sharon has commented on this. My father died. A couple of years later, my mother died. When my father died, all of us kids were devastated. Devastated. There were no end of tears, of turmoil. No. When my mother died, it was different. It wasn't the same. And my father wasn't the world's greatest father. He loved us. He had eighth grade education. He was a factory worker. He was not that articulate. I mean, he had great qualities that really stood out. Protection of his family, he's a great provider, always curious, oh, never stop learning, would sit and read the encyclopedia, you know, even though he never got out of high school, never got out of eighth grade, finished eighth grade. But he was a man of strength, a man of iron will in the sense that he never physically disciplined us. I never moved beyond his Mennonite upbringing. There was plenty of violent emotion there, but he would have exploded if he had touched one of us. He never did that. But anyway, he was a kind of idol, I think, for his children. I mean, the way we looked up to him. There was no one like him. And then he got old very quickly and then died. And that presence was gone. So there's a kind of an emotional and psychological dependency there that is permanent. My sisters in particular are still trying to figure out what their relationship is to my father. He's been gone for probably 20 years now. And I get that question. Because I'm the priest, you know. And I get questions like, do you think we're a dysfunctional family? Mm-hmm. Well, none of us has killed anybody yet, you know, and I try to pass it off. You know, and they'll ask me questions about our father and all this, and, you know, well, they're still trying to figure that out. So it doesn't go away. But as far as bad judgment is concerned, she makes an interesting link here. Unless such a child becomes healed of their idolatry, this pattern of feeling as though they need to be rescued and be taken care of, it can be there for the rest of their life. This is on the middle of 138. So she links it to idolatry. Remember, the last chapter was about idolatry. This one is about idolatry. We talked last week about, and the week, a little bit the week before, about those who want to be idolized and those who find that they can't function unless they have an idolatrous veneration for somebody or something, some group, some body. It gives us, it's rampant these days, I think, because society is so fractured. There's so little emotional and spiritual security, and people glom onto something that gives them a sense of identity, a set of standard ways of looking at things, and that sort of thing. So, you know, there's a lot of idolatry around, and you know, well, I've gotten off the track here for the specific point she's making. The specific point being this relationship between idolatry and the sense that we need to be rescued or taken care of in some way. It's an interesting link. Being dominated by an idol or an idolatrous relationship, and the necessity to be healed of that idolatry. In the end, in this chapter, that's what she advises us, that we need to deal with that. That is the root, that is the anchor for the kind of spiritual difficulty that she's describing. And so, if we believe we have bad judgment, then we need to have something to take the place of parental authority. Something. Could be almost anything, or someone. Marry someone. In the old days, it was very simple. The father ruled the family. Roman father had the power of life and death over their children, and they passed that authority on to the husband of the young woman, and life went on. That was the Roman way. They didn't worry about these fine points. Question number 4, why is a possessive Eve parent like a person in whom both the tares and the wheat are growing together? That's interesting. So there's some good growing going on. There are good things that are growing, thank goodness, inside of a person as they become part of who that person is. And those good things, are they going to prevail, or are the tares? And tares are those things that look like wheat but aren't, that can choke out the wheat, keep from any fruit being born. A possessive parent, an Eve possessive person, how is that parent like a person in whom both the tares and the wheat are growing together, as Jesus describes in the parable, Matthew 13:24? How can this create confusion in the child of such a parent? In other words, our parents are not all good. All parents have feet of clay. We start out as idols. Our little children think we're wonderful, and we try to be as wonderful as we can, and we enjoy that affection. But as they grow, they begin to realize, you know, some weird things about mom. There's some weird things about dad. There's some tares in there with the wheat. It's confusing. That's what I think she's saying.
Basically, these kids grow up with a 50-50. Either they're going to keep growing good, like wheat, or they're going to be choked out by tares.
That's true. I think that's true. And when I was first commenting on this, that was what was in my mind. But coming around to her particular question, she's talking about the parent. The possessive parent is like a person in whom both tares and wheat are growing together. And that is confusing for a child. I mean, we're all like that. Hopefully, we're not 50-50. Hopefully, we're, you know, 55-45, or, you know, more, you know, hopefully. 60-40. Whatever. And even if we're, and the most interesting characters in fiction are the people who are like 80-20, either one way or the other. Really good, real lots of wheat. But Abraham Lincoln, boy, when you get down to the tares, I mean, you know, it's something. You know, there's some weird things going on. And I don't mean to pick on Lincoln. He's, you know, just one of the best people I can think of. You know, but even Lincoln is not perfect. You know,
vampire or whatever it was.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, it probably, I mean, it expresses that side of his life. And there was a secret diary nobody knew about. But at any rate, or 80-20 the other way, all horrible and 20%. I mean, who can you write off? Who hasn't got 20% wheat that ended the tragedy of the good person that could have been being destroyed? by the tares. I mean, those are the interesting cases.
You think Hitler had 20% youth?
Well, he was human. There must have been...
There must be something there.
There must have been something. I'm not sure.
Did he grow up in a church? Maybe not Orthodox church, but...
I don't know anything about Hitler's religious upbringing. I know Stalin went to seminary, and that may be what you were thinking of. I don't think it made a positive difference in Stalin's case. So here we all are. I mean, it's, you know, you do the best you can. I hope your children forgive you for not having been what you seemed to be when they were five, you know, after they're grown up. It's a spirit. We talk a lot about the spiritual discipline of marriage, but the spiritual discipline of being a parent, that's what we're talking about here. So how can it create confusion? I have a note to 139, and that's where she talks about the tares and the wheat. Chrysostom says that sowing tares among the wheat. Now he's talking about what we as parents do to our children by sowing tares. What are these tares? Anything that isn't the way a human being is meant to be. Sometimes the things that we are absolutely convinced of are the things that we're afraid of and trying to overcome. And we pass those on to our kids. And sometimes we know what they are and we try to keep from doing that. And we do it anyway. And sometimes we don't even know what they are. But this sowing of tares among the wheat is the devil's craft. By the side of truth, always to bring in error, painting it with a resemblance to truth, trying to make it seem as much like good food, like wheat, as we can, as tares in appearance are somewhat like wheat, in order to deceive the deceivable. What are the consequences? Cain was exiled to the land of Nad, a word meaning confusion. A confused child may sometimes be the only obvious symptom when a mother is unwittingly established in the Eve pattern. In other words, you may never figure out that a parent is like this. A parent may never figure it out for themselves. But confusion in a child, it could have something to do with this, I think is what she's saying. And then she goes on to get more specific about it in the next question, question number 5. Do you see how Eve's possessiveness can arise from a desire to protect her child? Anybody want to comment on that? As a father, that's low-hanging fruit for me. I don't have any trouble seeing that. You want to protect your child, and you have got to keep from doing it, because you can keep them. You make them weak, keep them from developing. And they're going to be different than you. They're not going to be good at the same things that you're good at. Kathy's a mathematician. I mean, what do you do with this? As soon as she was introduced to addition and subtraction, she understood multiplication and division intuitively. Can you imagine? You know, I can't. You know, I mean, our kids are different from us. It's bad enough finding out after you get married how different the woman is from you that you married. And then it happens with your kids. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, everyone different than you and your wife, and all different from each other. Married life is chaos, you know, with a house full of different people in it. It's a wonder anybody wants to know. It's a wonder we're not all screwed, more screwed up than we are. Go ahead.
I'm just thinking, I seem to see this, you know, this people who, husbands and wives who have children, they have different ways of thinking about discipline, they have different ways of thinking about all kinds of things.
Sure.
And that's got to be real hard too, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like, that's got to be tough for, you know, the woman's thinking one way about discipline, and the man's thinking another way, and the woman's thinking one way about what the kids need, and the man's thinking another way about what their needs are.
There is no space between the difficulty you describe and the ability of a child to figure that out and take advantage of it. You know, you play the parent, the mother against the father, and the father against the mother. I mean, you know, they seem to be much more clever than we are.
Father Jacob, most of us aren't real consistent, but television writers have the luxury of being able to write people with extremely consistent personalities.
Right.
Everybody loves Raymond, if you've ever seen it.
Yeah.
The mother on there is this exact complex. She's always, everything I do for love. she'll say, and everybody rolls their eyes.
Raymond's mother. Oh, yeah, really.
Everybody rolls. Have you seen the show?
Oh, sure, sure.
So everybody rolls their eyes because she's obviously, she's trying to hold on to Raymond. She wants him, she resents.
She's got that Eve complex.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
She even gave, she finally gave a recipe once to Deborah. This recipe was the greatest meatballs in the world, and it came out wrong. She had actually given her a secret ingredient, and she put the wrong label on purpose. It was sugar instead of salt or something.
Right.
It was something that she wanted it to be bad so that she could maintain her position. So it's like, it's a caricature on this issue. And we think it's funny because we see it, but it's in large amplitude for us to see.
Right.
That's a great example of Dee Penick. Watch them. She could run her own.
Yeah.
She probably does better things with her time.
The first year and a half we were married, Sharon tried to duplicate the pancakes my mother made that I loved so much. And she got all of the Pennsylvania Dutch cookbooks and followed all the recipes and made everything from scratch. And she just fell flat. I mean, forget it. This is terrible. This is not it. And what come to find out, my mother used Bisquick. And made the pancakes and thinned them down because there were six of us.
Right.
You know. So it was very thin batter and the pancakes were always super thin, and that's how I wanted them. Well, you couldn't make that from a recipe. You had to take Bisquip and pour extra
milk or water
in it. That's the way I wanted it. So I don't know, something going on there, you know.
And she wouldn't let your wife know this?
Oh, well, we didn't ask her. We were on our own, you know. Sharon could make meatloaf when we were married. That was it. That's all she could. She hadn't boiled water, you know. She had made eggs and meatloaf. That was it. How can an aversion to love develop in children affected by parents in the Eve pattern? Now, here's serious business.
Yes.
How can an aversion to love develop in parents and children affected by parents in the Eve pattern? Okay, now we'll find out who read this.
Wouldn't you be kind of just like fearful getting close to anybody because there's going to be this head game kind of stuff going on? This crazy, this almost psychotic feeling of like, this person loves me. Okay, when's this controlling thing going to start happening? You
know? Because the child has become convinced that they know their parents love them. Mm-hmm. This parent loves them. And that's what love is for them. Yeah. And so that's what you take out into the world. That is the nature of love. And in this, so it is this possessive love, in quotation marks, where really your personhood isn't even fully acknowledged as a child. Because you are being possessed by this person that loves you as my child, my person. That is close to the idea of slavery. This is my person. I mean, it's different, but you can see possessiveness is possessiveness, and it cripples. You know.
I can't find it, but I read it earlier where she says that the parents has told the child this is love.
Right.
And they act in this way.
And they know, and the parent believes it.
Absolutely. The child believes this is love.
Yes.
So then when they go out and someone says, I love you, well, they don't want any of that.
Right.
You know,
exactly. Yes.
Which I think page 140 talks about it quite a bit.
Yeah.
I can't find that exact piece.
Eve's possessive devotion tends to create in her offspring a fear and hatred of what it believes love is, and the determination to separate from it. We see hatred of love in Cain. He kills his brother. A hatred of faithful commitment to love. Am I my brother's keeper? So this compulsion to oppose love and any challenging commitment to love is tied to an instinct for survival. So we've got some twistedness here. Love is identified as a killer, a consumer. There is, in fact, there's this horrible image of the consuming mother in Far Eastern mythology. You know, there are illustrations of it. This is like the mother as a source of death and the consumption of the children. You know, the Greeks have it with fathers too. But is that love? I mean, love is not love. It's consume another being, and if that's what you believe love is, you're certainly not going to go out looking for it. So the child's resolute inner purpose is to resist letting this love, in quotation marks, which it sees as a threat to its freedom, come too close. No wonder our society is such a mess. Question number 6, how do children influenced by a possessive parent often end up in the profound ignorance of pride, like Cain, in the land of Canaan, meaning confusion? Confusion, pride. Why? Because, I mean, because remember, when we're talking about love, I mean, love as it truly is the knowledge of God and the ability to know others because of our love of God. I mean, if a person's soul is not all twisted up because of this this distortion of our of the soul and how it operates in life, that's the reality. It's the opposite of pride. It's humility before God and the love of God, and you know, and an ability to love others in a way that God loves us. That is love, and nothing else is love.
So they get left in like a state of confusion, delusion.
Exactly, and it can lead to a kind of insanity. Remember what insanity means in our text, too. So it's either God's path to sanity, and God's path to being as God created us to be. And if the consequences, as you're saying, first the confusion, and then the pride, and then this a spiritual insanity, you know, where everything is upside down inside of a person. It's still the same person. We never lose the fact that God created us, the person that we are. But if our soul is in this kind of state of, you know, as D. Pennock says, this condition of turmoil, that the idolatry has plunged us, our soul into turmoil, being fixed on an idol rather than God. I mean, our job as parents should be to get our children to love God, to lead them to a love of God. If we don't love God, we're not going to be able to do that. And the only time the chapter comes around to that is when she starts talking about healing toward the end of the chapter. But yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, that's what happens. Question 7, what are some of the symptoms we might see in a person suffering from this confusion, you know, that you're talking about? I've picked out 142 as the place where I found this. That may not be the only place, but that's where I found it. Some of the symptoms. And this is the end point that we've already mentioned. You know, this spiritual insanity, not insanity the way we think about it in secular terms of psychology, but a spiritual craziness, of which there is no shortage in our society. Through that dense mental darkness of pride, they are fed proud and crazy thoughts from idols. This is a defense mechanism. We pick an idol, a substitute idol, maybe an idol that's really different from the one that we knew in our childhood. And the only way that we can get away from this is by persistent prayer for deliverance from pride. Because the idolatry and the pride go together. Idolatry will give you pride. It will make you proud. It will lock you into whatever the idol is. That's the way it works. We talked about this last week and maybe a little bit the week before. Remember when I talked about the Babylonians and their civil religion? The ideal was power. Power and control. That's what those empires were about. It was very raw. And their gods, their idols, that's what they were all about. And they brought out all of that in a human being. And the one who was the king, who was the most able to do that and forge this relationship with these terrible idols that brought out of a human being the ultimate in pride and power, the ability to dominate, a complete disregard for human life, a commitment to order and control and the empire. I mean, that sort of thing still goes on today, but it happens entirely inside of a human being. Some people think we all have a right to live like that. That's what it's all about. The isolated individual is everything. There are people who teach that. It leads to a spiritual madness, to a frenzy. May be that such a person appeals to other people. You know, there was a book that was written about Adolf Hitler quite a few years ago now called The Psychopathic God. And the idea was that Hitler was this powerful psychopathic personality that brought that sort of thing out of everyone that he dealt with and made them feel one along with what he was. And so he became that kind of a living idol to his people. Horrible, horrible vision. You know, but then on the other hand, it's history. You know, this is the sort of thing that happens.
Well, it seems to me, Father, that Jacob, that this leads to actual, what everybody would recognize as insanity, too, not just...
Well, but you keep it quiet, you know, and you could be an underling. I mean, you don't have to be full-blown, you know, psychopath. And besides, there's wheat there with the tares, and nobody's, you know, very few people are. What is the percentage of tares to wheat? And, you know, we were debating that in a man like Hitler. Not a lot of wheat, like a lot of tares, and those... You know, almost been radiated with, you know, atomic poisoning or something, just really twisted, you know, twisted human being. Most people aren't like that. Most people, we may be confused, we're trying to survive, we have the idols that we turn to for a sense of security and a sense of identity and all that sort of thing, but is it immediately recognized as being totally psychopathic and dangerous to everybody? Well, no. Because, I mean, if all you're trying to do is survive, you're saying is, well, once somebody gets to that point, won't everybody recognize it? Well, it depends. Time and place.
Really, I was just saying that, in the event that they were looked into, maybe they aren't recognized until they go into a theater and shoot everybody up, but in the event that you have a conversation with someone like that, I was wondering, it seemed like these are the same sorts of things you would find, only, you know, I think I see some of this in me. I mean, we all have some blind spots and we don't see things because of our pride,
right,
to some degree or the other. And there's some people that you meet and say, wow, he really doesn't have any idea how he's coming across. Now, I know I've been that person sometimes. And then there are people that, you know, they're completely out of touch with the reality of the world and talking to other people that you don't see. And,
yeah.
You know, that sort of thing. And I just wonder if it's a continuum. You know, there are people way on the other end.
Well, she does make a comment about that.
Does she?
Yeah. On page 150, she says, "The saints teach that our passions produce the abnormal blood chemistry observed in mental disorders and not the other way around." And then she has a discussion about that. Our tendency would be to say, there is something going wrong in this person and it produces this nuttiness. She says that our passions produce the abnormal condition that we find ourselves in when if we're talking about someone with a mental disorder.
What
page? Page 150 up at the top. Passions affect the brain, causing a disturbance or inflammation. We see passions like rage and terror and lust affect our body chemistry. So what we do with our passions, and partly what we've learned to do with our passions, or maybe we don't even know that we can do anything with our passions. There's a real tendency, you know, that people have today to assume that I am whatever I am like at an emotional and psychological level, and it deserves to be respected because it's the real me. And that's totally wrong, according to our understanding.
Because of the resurrection.
Well, we're not at the mercy of that because of the resurrection. It's totally not that way because God didn't create beings like that. There's brokenness and there's wrong choices and there's Eve parents and think they're gods and convince their children that love is their abnormal condition, things like that. When passions become so strong that they overpower a soul and take possession of it against a person's will, the saints have called them demons. There's an interesting thing that it's not like, you know, there are two things we don't want to do when we're talking about this kind of thing. We don't want to just say, oh, in other words, it's the demon's fault. There are these fallen angels. They are the ones who are responsible. No, the problem is that there is a link between our disordered passions and our strong passions and spiritual beings. Like we're on the same page. And if we're on the same page with those demons, can we blame them for the way we are? No. Why? Because we're human beings. We are not at the mercy of the demons. We are at the mercy of our passions. And our passions place us at the mercy of the demons, of these whatever demonic force it is. And when you're talking about this demonic force, you're talking about something that you and these spiritual beings that hate God have in common. So you form common cause. But that's because of our human choice. There is always an alternative for a human being because we are created in the image and likeness of God. Humility, fighting your way out of being controlled by pride, is always a possibility. And then she talks about that in this last section. But it has to be a persistent and intentional and very, she has a particular word that she uses for it when she talks about that kind of prayer. Importunity. It requires what it is called importunity prayer. As the person who wants bread, friend won't get up to give it to him because he's his friend, but because of his importunity, just won't go away. And so finally he gets up and gives him the bread that he needs, and so he goes on his way. And this is how. Now, we're not saying this is how God is. What we're saying is that that's what we need to do in order to fight ourselves free of these difficulties. Importunity prayer is needed. It's because of the way we are, not because of the way God is. Importunity prayer is needed for deliverance from big passions like pride, because we can't throw them off by ourselves. But in order to deal with ourselves, this is what we need to do. That means quantity, a lot of prayer, maybe 100 times or so, once or twice a day or more, persistent prayer. Because of not using importunity prayer, people fail to have their prayers answered. And the prayers that we're talking about having answered here are the prayers to have knowledge of ourselves and to deal with our pride. That prayer, you know, that's what we're talking about, not the, the Airstream trailer. So that's the story.
It occurs to me, Father Jacob, as you speak about demons and the way they attach themselves through a gradual process.
We turn to them more than anything. Yeah, yes, they are seeking us, but we're willing victims.
I remember C.S. Lewis talks about miracles, and Christ turning the water into wine was just showing. He makes mention he wasn't, I think he said something like turning a kittens into dragons or something. I forget what he said, but he wasn't just doing magic tricks.
Right.
He was actually doing what his father had always done, which
right.
was to take the water,
yeah.
which goes into the earth, and
right.
then goes up through the vine, into the grape, and is made into wine by human participation.
Yeah.
He's doing what his father had always done.
Yes.
You know, he didn't bring the part about the human participation, but now he's human, isn't he? But the time element is not there.
Right.
I mean, he does that.
I feel like I read that in Chesterton, in Orthodoxy, where he talks about how a miracle is only God's telescoping of time, so that something that has ordinarily would take a long time is done like that. It's the same thing, same event, same world, same everything.
The fishes, same thing.
Exactly, same
fish,
thing. He uses that
bread,
example
the
as
fish,
well.
The wheat and the But I'm thinking about the casting out of demons.
Right.
This quick, I mean, is it the same thing here where he's casting out demons? Is that a complete
In other words, does the person have to participate? What does Jesus generally asks? You know, there are those cases when he doesn't, and there's an explanation for why, and Theophylact explains this. But in those cases when someone comes to him for healing and he asks them about their, you know, about their belief, about their faith, now, 9 times out of 10, we take that and we make it into some kind of a crazy doctrine in some denomination. But what is really important there is that he is expecting the participation of the human being. That's part of it. And this is the point that you're making, is that there is a human participation aspect in these healings. Absolutely. And in here, when we're talking about spiritual effort and spiritual life, the highlight, because this is written to us, you know, God understands this. This is written to us. We need to understand the degree of participation necessary if we are going to change. No. The only thing, the only way we're going to be able to be changed is to desire to be other than the way we are. And not just as a kind of a passing, gee, it'd be nice if I weren't like this. No, it needs to be this importunity prayer. Because while you are doing that prayer, while you are desiring it, you are going closer and closer, moving more and more decisively toward God. As she says somewhere in here, these prayers are often not answered when we don't pray long enough, when we don't walk all the way to where the grocery store is, where we get what we need. Because of not using importunity prayer, people fail to have their prayers answered, like families who live out in the country, far away from where these prayers can be answered, far away from God, with the only grocery store 2 miles away. If they walk just 1 mile or half a mile, they won't reach the store to get the food they want. The same with prayers. They're often not answered because we don't pray long enough. We don't keep going. We don't get there to God, to bring ourselves to God. And that's the kind of participation we're talking about, which is, I think, in complete concert with what you're saying, it seems to me. And what we've gotten to here is the last question: what does Maximus the Confessor say it meant when Jesus gave the apostles power to cast out unclean spirits on page 152? Casting out demonic disturbances from our minds has been quite a normal event for Christians throughout the ages. Jesus gave the apostles power against unclean spirits. A person who receives that power, explains Maximus the Confessor, casts out unclean spirits. That is, he banishes the action of passions. Now remember, those passionate actions, remember the three parts of the soul, the thinking part, the desiring part, and the active part. We choose the best things, pass them on to our desires, desire the best things, desire God, desire virtue, desire purity, desire knowledge of ourselves, desire to be changed. But if we have the wrong desires, the active part of ourselves is going to automatically function. Once you get down to that level, there's an automatic function. So if we're going to change that, if we're going to cast out that uncleanness, how can that be done? We can gradually get rid of the passions ourselves through persistent praying, the action of passions being cast out of people, driven out by the faithful as we bear witness to Christ. All those challenging things that Jesus gives people as an answer to their desire to no longer be at the mercy of anger. And what does he do? He gives you three situations where you either give in to anger or you deal with it by turning toward him. 1, 2, 3. And if you turn toward him, 1, 2, 3, you've made some progress. There has to be that participation, obviously. It is important to pray for deliverance from believing and obeying old idols, because we are all influenced by idols to some extent in our early life. So we've all got something to deal with. There are families of saints, Basil the Great and Gregory and their sister. What's Basil's sister's name? I'm not asking you because this is a I don't remember. You know, you know me. I really don't. Even though we have an icon out there. Now, who is that? Family of saints. Their father was a saint as well.
I will check.
We should know. Okay. We don't all have the advantage of having been raised by saints. But the more saintly we can be, I mean, here is, you know, what can we do to raise our children better? Live our spiritual lives intensely. And it will immediately make a difference. It's the only thing that will immediately make the difference that needs to be made. The only thing. It's not just a matter of trying to strike a balance, thinking in terms that make sense to us in a worldly kind of way. We have got to make an intense spiritual effort. Nothing else will change us. Nothing else will make a difference to our children and pass on to them what they need. What's the name of the saint?
Saint Macrina.
You know, and both brothers, all the members of the family, considered Macrina to be the spiritual guide. Some people think that she was really, even when it came to the things that, you know, because when you're doing theology, you make spiritual choices. Is it all Basil the Great's personal knowledge of God, or is the knowledge of God that he had by way of instruction from Macrina is certainly probably part of it, both with respect to Basil and Gregory. And they would both say that. I think that would, I mean, there's no question about that. It's written in letters. Now there's a mother. We're talking brother and sister. But the effect that this woman had on the other members of the family was profound and deep. We don't do that for our children. This is 21st century when we're Americans. We pass all kinds of it. We receive it and pass it on. And even the secular psychologists know about that. I mean, the bad things that are passed on from one generation to another. Father Thomas Hopkins used to talk about that, how generation after generation can be fighting the same passions.
Father Jacob, I wonder sometimes if it's like, you know, the children of Israel who were in Egypt and have been delivered, or some of us who are making an attempt at being converted to Orthodoxy, if the best we can do is wander around the wilderness and die and hope that they can make it to the promised land. It just feels like...
Well, she talks about that.
The leeks and onions, does she?
Yeah.
I want the leeks and onions.
First you want to get rid of the demons, but afterwards you don't go wandering around because the demons will take the place of the ones that you got rid of. So our effort needs to be to deal with the realities of spiritual life, not to despair, because there is healing available, unless we just decide we're happier being the twisted people that we are. I mean, if that's our choice, that's our choice. And when we make that choice, then, you know, the demons are happy to oblige, and they give us the kind of life that we've chosen. So we have that choice. That's what it means to be a human being. We are not determined. Absolutely not. And there isn't anything as powerful and strong as the one who destroyed death. As Christians, we are not at the mercy of death. We simply are not. You know. So, there it is. I think we did okay on this chapter. There's more stuff in here. It's great. It's a good chapter. It's a difficult chapter to read, for a parent to read in particular. But if we're not parents, we're children. So... And all of the advice applies to the veneration of idols, which is as prominent today as it was in the time of the great Semitic kings of Babylon. No question. In fact, I see more and more similarities between our society and those days. Okay, any other discussion? Next week, we'll move on to chapter 9, the roots of willfulness. Okay. Thank you.